too. I had served on a jury once before, so I wasn't entirely new to the whole process. Nonetheless, that had been more than 10 years ago. Maybe 13, 14, I couldn't remember exactly. And it only ran for 4 days. In the county court too. Whereas the Erin Patterson trial would be in the Supreme Court and, obviously, it was going to be a different kettle of fish altogether. But the basic process hadn't changed. It was simply that everything would be so much bigger. Which meant my chances of making it through to the final 12 were correspondingly smaller. But all I could do was hope I kept making the cut. At every stage, there were excuses that could be invoked by those who wanted out, or eligibility requirements that Juries Victoria might deem we had failed to meet. Beyond that, it was largely random luck. I was one of about 15,000 people in the Latrobe Valley District who received a letter that February, and of those 15,000, nearly 7,000 were excused, deferred to a later time, or ruled unfit before we even got anywhere. You know the ones. I'd bet London to a brick on that at least half of you have done it yourselves. Jury duty, you say? Ugh, how can I get out of that? By late March, 1,400 of us had been randomly selected from the remaining 8,000, and we had been sent a second summons to attend court on the 28th of April. I was one of the lucky 1,400. This was a far greater number than would normally receive a follow-up summons, but the whole Latrobe Valley well knew what Juries Victoria also knew. This would be for the Patterson trial, which was going to be long and complex. Again, there was an option to be excused or seek a deferral, and by just sitting tight and saying nothing, I became one of 597 people who remained in contention. Now it became exciting. We were asked to confirm that we would be available for a minimum of 8 weeks. A minimum of 8? Sheesh. I imagine many of us who had previously said they had time for a lengthy trial began to hesitate. If it was a minimum of 8, what were the odds of it becoming 9, 10, or longer? Who in their right mind was genuinely happy to say they were willing to sacrifice 3 months of their life to jury duty? Clearly, to stay in the hunt, I needed to have another conversation with my business partner. Tony and I had known each other since art school in our early 20s and had fallen into starting a little framing business about 7 or 8 years before, when we both, separately, abandoned Melbourne for a cheaper life in the Latrobe Valley. Unfortunately, as much as our little company could do with some free promotion, if I named my business here, everyone would be able to identify me, so apologies for being a little mysterious. All I'll say is that we own a little shopfront in Morwell, with a factory out the back, and we have established enough of a client base to keep food on the table. At present, I wouldn't claim to be any richer than that. And Tony did know a retired woman in Outram who could look after the shop for a week or two while he kept the factory going. She'd done that for us before. But that wouldn't work for 10 to 12 weeks. Our locum from Outram wouldn't give us that much time. If I wanted to stay in line for this jury, therefore, we needed another solution. Luckily, from previous experience, I knew that until being sequestered to decide a verdict, jurors simply went home after court finished each evening. So I cut a deal. If I did make it all the way to the jury, and Tony looked after the shop each day while I was in court, I would spend 4 or 5 hours every evening cutting all the mounts and glass to size and then fitting up the frames in the factory. Then we could keep the business going while I applied myself responsibly to the call of civic duty. Deal done. I wasted no time confirming my availability to Juries Victoria, and I didn't disguise my enthusiasm. I threw my hand, metaphorically, in the air. Pick me, pick me. It transpired that 234 of us had thrown our hands in the air. But apparently, despite its massive profile, the Patterson trial wasn't the only longish trial due to start in the Latrobe district this winter. So that group of 234 had to be split in three, not equal thirds, but in three batches. There was nothing I could do to influence the outcome of the next decision. It was totally beyond my control, which, to put it mildly, sucked. But whatever. Okay, that's life. Roll with it. Juries Victoria gave each of us a number from 1 to 234. Then they split us into 112 possible jurors for the Patterson trial and 122 into a separate pool for the other two matters. Completely random. Numbers were just picked out of a barrel. You were either in one or the other. Damn, my luck held. Now we were down to 112. So that was the initial pool for the Erin Patterson trial. There were 112 of us who were instructed to attend Morwell Court on the 29th of April, and I was given the number 78, which, considering I was born in 1978, was pretty easy to remember. From here, I sort of knew what to expect. It was the process I had been through all those years before, but this time on steroids. All 112 of us would turn up and we'd get a lengthy, learned dissertation from the judge and all the other excuses that might exclude us from being part of the final draw. And then however many were left would have their numbers put into a box. Yes, literally a wooden box. And in a completely random order, those numbers would be drawn out. Anyone chosen would then walk past the accused and the prosecution to the jury box. Okay. So, it was still unlikely. The odds had shortened, for sure, but I was only one of 112 possible jurors. The night of the 28th of April, I checked the weather forecast for the next day. 20 degrees and cloudy, so temperate. What should I wear in those conditions? It was hardly an easy decision, knowing that if I were lucky enough to get my number called, I would have to walk past the accused without being challenged. In the Victorian legal system, the accused has the right to object to at least three people being on the jury with no reason needed. But what would Erin find objectionable? Considering she had once made a choice to appear on national television wearing socks with Birkenstocks, answering what Erin Patterson might find objectionable was beyond me. To make progress, I decided to reverse the question. Instead of wondering what she might object to, perhaps I should ask myself what might appeal. I was, after all, on her side. I was going to present as a totally neutral, unbiased member of the community who privately happened to think, she was probably innocent. Attitude, I decided, was more important. Just wear comfortable, me clothes, but appear warm and empathetic. Don't try and second-guess or overthink anything. What will be, will be. On the morning of the 29th of April, I took the train three stops to the Morwell Courthouse, which is a two-storey chocolate box piece of public architecture whose ambition was to project a modest level of regional authority rather than seek the spotlight of world attention. The matters heard inside its walls were usually drink-driving charges from last year's Christmas parties and domestic violence AVOs. While I do not in any way wish to belittle the broader social issues these matters highlight, they were somewhat overshadowed now by a chilling triple murder trial. It was hard to escape the feeling that it all looked out of place. Australia was world famous for the Melbourne Cricket Ground, the Sydney Opera House, Uluru, and now, soon to be tacked onto that impressive list, would be the Latrobe Valley Law Courts in Morwell. I flashed my summons letter and was ushered through. But because this jury pool was so much larger than normal, about half of us crowded into the trial courtroom, which was courtroom 4, and the rest were bundled into courtroom 5, next door with a separate supervisor, and an audio and video link. Someone had opened a can of people and shaken them out onto the floor. That's what we looked like. Up on the bench, however, draped in his antiquated robes of office but sans wig, Justice Christopher Beale made his first appearance. His initial concern was making sure the supervisor in courtroom 5 could hear him and the tech was all working properly, and while he embarked on this quick minute of housekeeping, I wondered how judges secured these appointments. Was there a roster? Did the Attorney General merely decide who she wanted? A coin toss, maybe. All right, Justice Beale concluded. If there are any problems with the live stream during the course of the empanelment, please bring that to my attention as soon as possible. Ironically, the most experienced person in the courtroom when it came to sorting out problems with live stream technology was actually Erin Patterson herself, a fact we would soon discover. Erin had been in the dock from the beginning, trying, it appeared to me, to disguise her mild feeling of irritation at having to put up with this whole exercise. "Mr. Associate, please arraign the accused," continued Justice Beale, pivoting to the case at hand. In front of the entire jury pool, the charges against Erin were read out. One charge of attempted murder, and three charges of murder. Predictably, she pleaded not guilty to each. But hang on, one charge of attempted murder? Over the last couple of days, during which the beginning of this case had attracted blanket publicity, all the prelim stories had said she was facing four charges of attempted murder, three against her husband Simon, and one against the surviving lunch guest, Ian Wilkinson. Now it was only one. What had happened? Had Erin got out of three charges already? That wasn't a bad start. "Good morning, members of the jury panel," said His Honour, rudely interrupting my train of thought. "You are here so we can select a jury to sit in a criminal trial where the accused, Erin Patterson, is charged with three counts of murder and one count of attempted murder." Yes, we all knew that. "It will be the task of the jury that is selected in this trial to decide whether the accused is guilty or not guilty of those charges." Duh. But okay, some formalities must be gone through. Fair enough. He went on to explain that 15 jurors would be impaneled initially, which meant that if three fell sick or were unable to continue for some reason, the trial would still have the 12 jurors required to deliver a legally binding verdict. If there were more than 12 of us still left when the trial finished, the excess one, two, or three jurors would be randomly balloted off to leave 12 to reach a verdict. Great, got it. Now, come on, pick the jury. But no, not yet. First, 5 minutes of COVID protocols were read to us. COVID protocols? Is that still a thing? Apparently so. After that, things got a little more serious. Every juror had to be completely open-minded about the case, warned Justice Beale, which was exactly what I had been saying to everyone else for months. Go me, I thought. Sometimes, especially in country areas, a potential juror knows one of the people involved in the trial or knows something about them and so may not be able to be open-minded. Even if the juror feels capable of treating the people involved in the case fairly, to the outside world it may seem likely that they will favour one side or the other, which would undermine the interests of justice. We were handed the list of witnesses, and while we could all read, Justice Beale announced he was nonetheless going to say all their names out loud himself. "And if you know any of these people or think you may know them, you must ask to be excused." Fat chance, I thought. I mean, maybe I did, but what do you mean by no? I'd framed hundreds of school certificates and prints for medical practices and diplomas and degrees and ribbons and medals for sporting achievements and all that sort of stuff. But they could have been brought in to us by anybody. Receptionists, secretaries, mums and dads. I couldn't put names to all those faces. I often see people at Woolies or somewhere and I know I've framed something for them. I'm a good framer, but I don't know them. Names, therefore, meant little. Beale read through all the civilian witnesses, the medical witnesses, the expert witnesses, the police witnesses, and finally, other relevant people. I could honestly say I might have met some of them, but I didn't know anyone. No fudging here. hand on heart, all good. Then it came to places. They could also be a problem. What? What did he mean by places? The schools involved, the churches involved. If we had an association with any of them, we had to excuse ourselves. Well, in my business, we deal with schools all the time. We frame all the awards they need for their speech nights, or when they want to thank sponsors for their fundraising, or when they put a fete on. Sometimes they ask us for a donation and we give them part of their payment back. That's business. But all that's like, well, half a dozen emails in 2 weeks out of the whole year. Is that an association? I went with no. Next came a solemn lecture on the dangers of having already heard too much about the case. To be fair, Justice Beale did acknowledge right off the bat that we must have all heard the essential scenario. The coverage the case had already received over the previous 20 months had been so extreme that picking a jury that knew nothing about the case would be impossible. Safe in that knowledge, he quickly ran through the bare bones of things. He expected we all knew that Erin had hosted a lunch in July 2023, to which she had invited her estranged husband Simon, who hadn't attended. She'd also invited Simon's parents, Don and Gail Patterson, and Simon's aunt and uncle, Heather and Ian Wilkinson. All four of them had accepted. Erin had served individual parcels of beef Wellington at the lunch, and three of the four guests, Don, Gail, and Heather, subsequently died from death cap mushroom poisoning. One lunch for five, three dead. That does not happen often. I quickly glanced at the other 50 or 60 potential jurors in the main courtroom and the rest on video next door, and there was not one flicker of surprise from anyone. None of this was news to any of us. It is unrealistic, Beale continued chattily, to expect that the jurors selected can erase that prior information from their minds, but it will be their task to bring an open mind to their consideration of the evidence and decide the case solely on the evidence that is led in this trial, not on any prior or outside information. Yep, fine, okay. As potential jurors, you have to consider whether you can bring an impartial, open mind solely to the evidence that will be led. If you can't, or you think you may struggle to do that, you must ask to be excused. If you have listened to any of the podcasts about the case, you should ask to be excused. Jesus, did a couple of minutes here and there count? The ABC podcast kept popping up on my Instagram, for example, although it was more like a clip, just an ad for the whole thing. But it was still an excerpt from this episode or that episode, so sure, I'd heard this and that. But not the whole podcast, at least not the way I'd define it. I wasn't going to fall on my sword over that. What was the court trying to say here anyway? That anyone with a normal 21st century connection with social media had to bar themselves from jury duty? If that's true, by 2040, only a few fringe Luddites and crazies would qualify to be jurors. Maybe some new ambitious law reform advocates should look at this. Can the jury system move with the times? I think it might have to. But we'll come back to that topic as we progress. There will be plenty of opportunities. If you have taken a particular interest in this case, that is, an interest over and above reading the occasional article or listening or watching the occasional news report, you should seek to be excused. I stopped listening. If from the prior media coverage you have already formed a view about Miss Patterson's innocence or guilt, you should ask to be excused. Courtrooms could really do with better interior decoration, I thought. And frankly, a few stylish pieces of wall art, that'd help. Even if you haven't followed the media coverage, but because of conversations with others who have, you have formed a view about Miss Patterson's innocence or guilt, then you should ask to be excused. I should put together a proposal. Restrained, but provocative. Some moody Lloyd Rees landscapes, maybe, teamed with a couple of Sid Nolan's Kelly series, Ned Kelly in the Dock. That'd liven the place up. And I should add, this case is likely to attract a high level of media attention. Or some good First Nations works. Let's challenge the whole subservience our legal system currently has to the monarchy of Britain. Wouldn't that be great? If you feel that level of attention will cause you to feel highly anxious and impede your performance as a juror, please ask to be excused. What? Sorry, I missed that last bit. Also, the jurors selected should ignore the ongoing media coverage. If a story comes on the news about the case, they should change the channel. The channel? I glanced at the 15 or 20 of us who were under 30. They were clearly puzzled. What's a channel? I could hear them think. Should we ask? Can we ask? Can we Google it? If they see an article about it, they should turn the page. The page? If you're not willing to do that, you should ask to be excused. What? Now, be aware that if any of you own a mobile phone or similar devices, just to remind everyone, this trial was in 2025, and we had a judge, a smart, educated judge in a modernised Western country, wondering if any of us might own a mobile phone. Right. If any of you own a mobile phone, you will not be allowed to have your phones physically on you while the court is sitting, including during the morning and afternoon breaks, or if you are sent out to the jury room while there is legal argument taking place in the court. If you can't tolerate being separated from your mobile phone during the court sitting times, you should seek to be excused. A few minutes later, the jury pool of 112 was down to 87. After the judge's preliminary instructions, his associate had called out each of our numbers and, as each number was called, we either had to answer present or excuse. And 25 of us either knew one of the witnesses or really couldn't leave our phones. We were down to 87. And the 87 of us who were left immediately put our phones on silent, hid them, and managed as best we could for the rest of the trial. Like, you know, I had a 20-year-old son at uni in Melbourne who texted his need for a money transfer about 3 times a day, and sometimes that was because he was at a petrol station and he'd already filled up and he was stuck there until I transferred him the $20, as if I could lose phone contact for hours at a time. Could anyone in 2025? Give me a break. Anyway, more on that later. Because, as the trial unfolded, we all came to realise that if anyone in the courtroom was a true genius at secretly swapping, hiding, and managing phones in a combative environment, it wasn't any of us. It was Erin Patterson. She was good at this stuff. She was the best in the room at livestream and the best in the room at phone tech, by a proverbial country mile. She was much smarter than she looked, and a guru when it came to normal civilian tech, which in the end worked against her more than for her. But you still had to tip your hat. After that, to reduce the pool of 87 to an impaneled jury of 15, it was a lottery. First, all our numbers were placed in a wooden box. I know, believe me, I have checked the dates several times and it is 2025. But I swear that instead of random selection by an encrypted computer program, the Supreme Court of Victoria still manually puts bits of paper in a wooden box and draws them out by hand. And as each number is called, that person stands and walks to the jury box. As they walk, the accused can call challenge, or the prosecution can call stand aside. But if you make it to the jury box before either of those announcements are voiced, you are a juror. Some quick maths meant I had about a 1 in 6 chance of being called to run the gauntlet of surviving challenges, but all I could do was wait. It soon became apparent the prosecution was not going to challenge anyone. They simply were not interested in that game. Just give us any jury, they seemed to be saying. But Erin did challenge. She challenged and dismissed 2 prospective jurors pretty quickly. Then waited. 11 jurors had taken their seats when the 14th number was picked out of the wooden box. The associate called out the number with the same flat monotone he had used for all the other numbers. 1, 7. Oh my God. 7. Damn, so close. How could... No. Juror number 77 was a young, evangelical-looking man with a short, conservative haircut whose occupation was announced as human resources. What humans he had the experience to resource was not immediately obvious, and Erin instantly challenged. I could see her point. I could feel my hopes fade. 1 spot left. What were the odds of number 78 being called straight after 77? Google has since told me that statistically the odds are exactly the same as any of the other numbers being picked out. But sitting in courtroom 4 on that Tuesday morning, that didn't seem likely. My dream of playing a role in a globally reported moment in history was not going to happen. Story of my life, I thought. I'd done everything I could. I'd put myself in a good position, but I had no control over the final outcome. It would be sheer bad luck. Some people, of course, will always say, you make your own luck. I've never liked those people. They can never admit they are not completely in charge of their own success. They have to give themselves agency. The dice fell their way for no particular reason, and they cut a break. But they still have to say they made it happen, somehow. But I was feeling sorry for myself far too soon. The next number announced was indeed number 78. Oh my God, I'd never won lotto in my life, and here I was. It had happened. In a moment of shock, my glands released a hit of adrenaline. Just act normal, my inner voice shouted as I tripped while standing up. I knew Erin could still object, but to object a 4th time, she would need to give a reason. Had I given her one? I didn't know. I can't remember the walk across to the jury box. That's a blank. I was just annoyed at nearly having screwed it all up. But I didn't hear an objection, and as soon as my bum hit the seat, which was cold, why so cold, I glanced at Erin and smiled. She stared back. I could almost hear her thinking, what are you smiling for? This isn't funny. Maybe I should have objected. It was too late now, though. We were quickly empaneled, and I was on the jury for the ride of a lifetime.